Blog Talk Radio.
On October 30, 1990, a young woman by the name of Cynthia Lorraine Ricketts Richardson was executed and dismembered by her husband, Donald Glenn Richardson. Her body parts were scattered over a 50-mile area in and around the Columbia River in the state of Oregon. As if the abuse Cindy suffered at the hands of her husband wasn't enough, the state of Oregon delivered its own brand of injustice to not only Cindy and her family, but to a second family as well. That is, when Donald was released from prison after only a 25-year sentence for his heinous crime against his wife. When Donald was released due to a new law that had been passed by the state legislature, he committed a crime so horrible it should have earned him the death penalty. Sadly, he will be released from prison in 2023. The family has fought for years to keep him in prison even before he was released the first time. This is Cindy's story. This is finally the justice she nor her family ever received at the hands of the criminal justice system in Oregon, from the attorney general down to the psychiatrist who stated that he was not a danger to others. While he was awaiting trial for Cindy's murder, his defense attorney stated in court that it was just a garden variety murder. Now Cindy can rest and her family can find the peace that has eluded them for so many years. Justice for Cindy by Yvonne Mason, available today on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
It is Friday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and this is Off the Chain with your host, Yvonne Mason. And yes, that was yet another piece of shameless self-promotion. That is my latest book, Justice for Cindy, and I encourage every one of you to go out and get it because it is a true crime, and it does show that we do have states in our country that have very, very liberal criminal justice laws, and the unintended consequences of those criminal justice laws do lead to more heinous crimes. So go today and get it, Justice for Cindy by Yvonne Mason. Tonight, this show is not only informative and educational, but it is going to open up some things that many of you do not know, have probably no clue about, and on the other hand, there are those of you who have been crying out forever for help. Tonight our show is with CPS activist Jim Black. He is the founder of and lead researcher at Angel Eyes Over Texas. In 2015, he was elected vice president of the Grandparents Rights Association of the United States. Both organizations advocate for family rights on both state and federal levels. Jim's professional background is in neither law nor social work, but instead as a manufacturing engineer specializing in automotive manufacturing system. In 32 years, he worked specialty contracts for more than 52 enterprises, covering such areas as petrochemical, oil field production, offshore drilling, cardiac surgical instruments, automotive, aerospace, and numerous other fields in between. His experience was not only varied, but it provided him a very diverse set of management skills. Now, his exposure to Child Protective Services, and we will call it tonight CPS, began with his own children in 1992, with various bouts with them in 94 and 97. Then in 2000 and 2001, he began dealing with them again over his grandchildren. But it was not until 2009 that they and when they were removed that his battle really began. Early in the case, he began noticing inconsistencies in how the Texas system was designed and how it was managed. In 2010, Angel Eyes Over Texas was created to research and break down the mechanics of how the system has not only failed, ladies and gentlemen, but it is corrupt. So corrupt. By taking an engineering approach to the system, he is able to separate emotion from facts and present truly logical remedies. Jim, thank you so much for coming on this show tonight. This is something that has been in the dark way, way too long.
Yes, it is. And the more we learn about it, the more we realize we don't know about it. As you said, I didn't start really researching until my grandkids were taken in June of 2009. We were lucky that they were unable to terminate parental rights, and we got them back in March of 2014, just under 5 years.
But that's 5 years that you'll never get back with your grandchildren.
And that's very true, and it's also the children you get back are not the children that you lost. They have taken a different path during that time. Dealing with them, they don't understand. Even though you have visitation, they don't fully understand what happened. They remember. My granddaughter was 7 when they took her, and she remembered what she was taught up until 7 years old, and she tried to teach her brother about our family, but she was teaching him from a 7-year-old's perspective.
Correct.
So by the time 5 years went by, she had lost perspective of how the family truly was. And so then that created problems. By that time, my granddaughter, she came home at 12 years old. And, of course, if you dealt with teenage daughters, that is a very difficult time in any family's life without being separated for 5 years. She had matured tremendously after being mother to her little brother. He was 9 months old when they took him, and he came home right before his 5th birthday.
He basically, even though it was family, came into a home of strangers.
Right. For him, coming home was like a removal.
Right.
Very much like a removal.
Because he had already bonded with a family of strangers when he was taken out of your home. You there, Jim?
I'm sorry, I got interrupted for a second. My daughter came up with something that she wanted to, during the time they were gone, and like I said, we can prove that the case was falsified. But okay. we can prove that the case was falsified. Sorry, my daughter's wanting me to get it out right quick. They put child support on her. That's the main thing she was trying to get pointed out. They put child support on her while she was gone, and then they didn't waive it when they came home. So she owes almost $30,000 in child support for a case that the children, that the investigations were falsified to begin with.
And that is one of the problems that we have with the crookedness of child protection services. Not only do they remove children from homes that, first of all, don't need to be removed, but then they falsify information, then they turn around, pay the foster care providers, they get bonuses, the judge gets a bonus, and then they sue the parent for child support when the parent had no responsibility in having the child removed in the first place.
Yes, and that's one of the things that we're actually, we have a bill, correction. I'm not sure if the bill has been filed yet. It may be on a plank list for the Texas legislature, but we are wanting to put a restriction on child support during that first 12 months when they remove and you're going through all the temporary orders hearings. We're trying to get that removed so that that does not go against the parents, because so often you will have a family that was intact and there was no child support, and all of a sudden now while the family is trying to get back up on their feet, they're suddenly having to pay child support over something that they had no real impact on.
Yeah, it's what makes it even worse, Jim, and is that they, Child Protective Services, loves to go after poor families because they had, number one, they're already beat down. They're struggling as it is to get on their feet. Number two, they are intimidated by the big bad boogeyman that beats on their door, and there's no way in hell they can pay $30,000. Not saying your daughter's poor, but nobody can pay $30,000 in back child support. That's ridiculous.
Yes, and the main reason they go after those families is to qualify for much of the Title IV funding. They have to qualify for TANF, or
yes,
else
they do.
They don't get that funding. So they go after the poor families that cannot afford, they have to have a court-appointed attorney, and half the time the court-appointed doesn't do their job, which that's another area that we're wanting to try and have more teeth to in Texas during our next session. Which if anybody's been paying attention, Texas is up against the wall, and the state has been sued by the feds on behalf of 12,000 children in long-term foster care, claiming that Texas violated their constitutional rights by failing to protect them after they removed them from their families.
And that is also something that happens on a daily level. These children are taken out of homes of families where they're loved and put in strangers' homes where they're abused. And not only are they abused, Jim, but if they get bounced around in the foster care system until they're 18 years old, and then they're kicked to the curb, and you've got 85% of them going into the penal system.
Yes, because these children have no support. Moral support you know, you have a child that graduates high school or even if they don't go to college, they still fall back and deal with mom and daddy from time to time.
Exactly.
But these foster children, when they age out at age 18, there is no real mom and daddy to fall back to. I mean, you know, some of the adoptive or, well, if they aged out, they weren't adopted. But these caregivers, you know, all they were doing was collecting a paycheck. They didn't really teach. And the child ages out. Half of them don't even know what even the state has to offer them. I was quite upset here. 2 weeks ago, I was watching a Texas hearing, and the caseworker that falsified our investigations now is in charge of the Preparation for Adult Living program.
Oh, that's wrong.
And she was bragging about how she's in charge of six counties. But yet, at protests here in Houston, we have had former fosters come up and they didn't even know their true identity. They did not ever get a birth certificate or anything to prepare them for adult life. And here the very same person that robbed 5 years from my grandchildren isn't ensuring that these children that are aging out has the proper credentials to even find a job. And we have run up against this 4 or 5 times. We'd be holding a protest here in Houston, and these young adults start coming up and asking us questions about how can we do more. And now we do have a couple of alumni organizations in the Houston area that are trying to help these young people. There's a group called Angel Reach that helps these young people, but it's quite a bit. It's not, these people, these kids, they don't have really true access to the internet or anything like that. You know, half of them are barely surviving on the streets, so they don't even have cell phones. So how can they find out about some of this stuff whenever they're already out of the system?
They can't. And what makes it even more sad, if it could possibly get even more sad, is if these children wind up being adopted either by the foster care provider or someone, yet another stranger, when they're 18, they're still kicked to the curb because the money runs out.
Very true. And we've seen that quite often. And we've had very few instances that we have seen kids actually be able to fall back and rely on their caregiver. And that's another area that we need to build awareness. But the main problem that I'm running into, and like I say, I analyze things a lot differently than most people. You know, we've got corruption in the system. The system has taken on a life of its own.
Yes, it has.
And what people and when I think of something taking on a life and becoming autonomous on its own, I can't help but think back to robotics and think back to when robotics first started coming into existence. They set up the three laws of robotics so that they could control the artificial intelligence of the robotics to keep it from overriding mankind. Well, a few years ago, I started thinking on setting up basically a set of constitutional rights very similar to the parental rights that we have, that they have been trying to get put into the Constitution for a number of years. But this system needs to be defined with parameters to where it cannot go beyond those parameters, and all the laws related to it needs to be adjusted in that manner. So, and one of the things that I noticed, if you deal with CPS or with any length, you'll hear the word permanency come up. And
all
what are the permanency goals? And you have a list of about 6 goals that they're all the time talking about. But there's one that nobody ever talks about. It's not in any list. And that's permanency zero. Permanency zero means you get the services to prevent that child forever having to go into the system.
Yep.
We need to concentrate on permanency zero so that that child never has to adjust to that system.
But when they do that, Jim, let's say that that happens, which one day I hope it does, it immediately cuts off the money county offices are given and the bonuses that the caseworkers are given and the money that goes into the judge's court when the kids are adopted out. It's all about money, and I agree. We need permanency zero. We need to give these people that don't have any way of pulling themselves up the things they need to be able to have a life. I agree wholeheartedly, but first we have to get rid of the corruption.
I agree that, and I run into it a lot differently across the state of Texas. Our system is so large, Texas is the largest state that we have a full statewide system. We're broken into 11 different regions, but everything still operates basically on a full statewide scale. But yet, when you start going to the courts, we have the regular juvenile courts, and we have the regular family courts in the larger metropolitan areas. But then you get into some of the rural areas, and we have what is called what used to be called cluster courts, but they're now called the CPS court system, that you have one judge covering, say, 5 counties.
Right.
And they answer to 5 different sitting judges in those counties. But then when there's overflow, CPS cases get heard even as low as a JP court in certain parts of the state.
And I thought it was bad in Georgia.
And a JP judge doesn't even have to have a law degree. So basically you're looking at 4 different types of court systems that Texas deals with. And each one of them has their own set of rules and stuff, and which brings me up to another area that I've been debating with the various lawyers about it, and that's Texas does not have a set of rules for juvenile and family procedure. Most of the time when you look up a state and you start researching how to fight, the first thing you look up is the rules for civil procedure. Because
right.
So many people don't realize that you're dealing with a civil lawsuit. You're not dealing with a criminal case. Only about 1 out of 17 CPS cases actually has criminal charges filed. So in the civil case, you're neither guilty or innocent. you're dealing with the opinion of the person you're up against. And unless the state has defined rules for juvenile and family procedure separate from civil procedure means you're acting under the same rules as you would on a fender bender out here on the street. And that's how they get away with a lot of the hearsay and everything else, is because you're under a much weaker set of rules when you're arguing a case in civil court than you are in criminal court. And so they allow evidence that would have normally been kicked out. And that's the reason that we're pushing to get the Texas Supreme Court to develop a set of rules for juvenile and family procedure, opposed to strictly using the civil rules of procedure, because we feel that these courts need to operate on a much stricter guidelines than you do under a general civil. Need to basically give you an example of what got me into all of this. When the children were taken, one of the first activities that they had us do, I looked up in the handbook to know what to expect that day when we went to CPS. What I experienced and what I read was two totally different things. And the more I studied the Texas handbook, the more it read like a fairy tale.
Uh-huh.
And as a manufacturing person, I'm used to an enterprise. You set up a manual for that enterprise. That controls your quality control and everything else. And if you don't follow those guidelines, you're nothing but an insubordinate employee.
Exactly.
And that's basically what we're up against. The states set up all these statutes and laws and such have you, policies and procedures. When they don't follow them, you're dealing with nothing but an insubordinate employee, because you're not following what your employer, the people of your state, laid out for you to do your job. And so you're running up against that. Very few states have a statute that nullifies good faith immunity. And good faith immunity is basically, well, if you're in a situation and one of your peers was in the same situation, would they do things the same way that you are doing them now? Well, if you pay attention to CPS, quite often, basically all of them do that. So you need a statute that spells out that this absolutely is not acceptable. And if you break one of these rules, then you lose your immunity to civil and criminal prosecution. And Texas does have a statute that calls out perjury, fabricating evidence. If you know that the parent did not abuse a child, you're mandated to let it be known. And the fourth one is if you break any Texas or federal law during the investigation or prosecution of a case, you lose your immunity. Now, when you drop back to the federal level, they mention qualified immunity, but there's a stipulation about pre-existing law. If a state does not have it pre-existing to define that it is a violation of their immunity, it is hard to win a federal case. And I've seen federal 1983 cases lost because they did not apply the immunity that Texas. We had a grandmother that she won the case. They said that her rights were violated, but there was no monetary penalty because the attorney that prepared the case did not point out where Texas had pre-existing law that nullified the immunity. So basically it was about $150,000 down the drain on that federal lawsuit.
And that's a shame. And sadly, from what I've studied and the handbooks that I've read and the workshops that I've looked at that were online, especially in Georgia, caseworkers are trained on A, how to manipulate, B, how to lie, and C, how never to return children to their families. In fact, in the Georgia handbook, it plainly states there is no family permanency. Work towards adopting out.
Last year, in February of 2015, Texas, the workers have been complaining about the handbook being hard to use, and they stripped what they claimed to be a bunch of policy out of the handbook. They stripped 450 pages, more than 670 topic items out of the handbook, and a good bit of that dealt with reunification. So right now, there isn't a solid source to look into in Texas on what the true reunification patterns are. That's another area we're trying to get put back, but right now that's still down the line. We have a major major session coming up in January. We're dealing with there have been hundreds of children that are not being seen even for the first time. There was a point here about 2 months ago that there was more than 250 P1 investigations in the Houston area that had not even been seen the first time, and it was going on 45 days, and a P1 is supposed to be taken care of within 24 hours.
Absolutely.
Looking at it from a manufacturing point of view, the social worker delivery model will never work. It will always act like a sponge and absorb everything around it until it goes into crisis. Then
yep.
The state go and throw more money out there to hire more caseworkers, and you patch it for maybe a year or two, and then you find yourself right back into the same situation. Now, I haven't got it clear from the Texas commissioner yet if his new approach matches what I have speculated that it is, but he is wanting to send out special investigators along with a social worker for the first visit. The special investigator has, in Texas, is usually a retired police officer or somebody with anywhere from 10 to 15 years law enforcement experience before they went to work for CPS.
And they are better qualified to, because of their background, to see if there is viable abuse rather than just being poor, and to observe without prejudice.
Right, and that's one of the things when I talked to the commissioner last July, I pointed out that you need your basically first responders that go out, and their only job is to go out and assess the situation right off the bat. And on the forensic side, they need to be able to look and say, okay, this is a true criminal situation, and from day one they can start preserving evidence. But
exactly.
With that social worker at his side, they can say, okay, this is a bad situation, but now the social worker can kick in and say, this is what we can offer. And another area that I'm working up a presentation on is separating all social work activities from investigations and substitute care, because people fear going and getting services from the same agency that can possibly take your kids.
And that is a very good point, because once you're in the system, you live in fear from that point on.
Oh, yeah. And even after you get out of the system, you live in fear, where any time you hear a knock at the door or anything, you're running and checking the windows to see if you can see what kind of car is here or whatever. And the children live in fear of a CPS visit. It doesn't matter how long it's been over. It's a constant reminder. It affects the family tremendously.
Oh yeah, there's always that pit in the bottom of your stomach that tightens in a knot when the phone rings or somebody that you don't know is at the door, because are they coming to take us away again? Are the family saying, well, what have we done now? And nobody should ever have to live in that kind of Gestapo fear.
No. And you have a situation like, okay, we have three boys, 8, 5, and 4. And you can imagine they get wrestling and playing around, and one of them gets a knot on the head or a black eye or something, goes to school, and next thing you know, you've got CPS knocking at your door over something that is just normal, everyday boys wrestling and type situation. But then you're dealing with CPS when they don't think that way. They're looking for any and every excuse to get in. And so
same thing with doctors. You take your child to a doctor, say you can't even let your kid ride a bike or go out and play anymore, because if the kid gets hurt and you have to run them up to the emergency room because they've broken their arm, first thing the doctor's going to say is, we're bringing a social worker in. So you get to the point you don't even want to take your kid to the emergency room because you've got to deal with people taking your child in the hospital.
Yeah, we experienced that last year. The youngest was throwing a fit, and you know how young children will throw themselves backwards sometimes. And he hit his head on the corner of his bunk bed, and he had to have 3 staples in his head. Well, took him to get him out, and we were about a week late on taking him out. Well, the doctor filed a case.
Oh, good Lord.
Because we had to, and part of the reason we waited a week is it didn't look like the cut had healed properly. It was still draining some. So we waited an extra week. Well, we had to deal with that. A couple of months ago, I had a grandmother contact me from North Texas, and she says, I was at a pediatrician's office today, and a lady walked in and identified herself from being with CPS and asked if the doctor had any cases for her. So they're actually going around and patrolling these pediatricians to collect cases.
And it's all about the money, Jim. We're back to the money, ladies and gentlemen. Jim and I keep talking about the money. In 1996, when Bill Clinton was the president of the United States, he and his wife Hillary put together a program. It's called the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And before that time, when children were removed from the home and put into foster care, nobody made any money. But they decided that because caseworkers were removing children, that there was money to be made. This is why Jim and I say that children are bought and sold. And part of the Adoption and Safe Families Act was this. When a child is removed and put into a foster care provider's home, that foster care provider is paid for that child. Now, if they're siblings, they are paid even more money for siblings. They're also paid for those children to school clothes, gasoline to take children wherever they want to go. They're paid for birthdays. They're paid for Christmas. They're paid for you name it, they're paid for it. And the reason I know this, number one, I have the bill, and number two, when my three grandchildren were removed from my daughter, the foster care provider had all three of them, and she made $1,600 a month just on those three children. She had five more children that were foster care children. So she made money off of those children. Now, she didn't work outside of the home. She and her husband lived in a 200-square-foot house with two bedrooms. So she had to rack and pack and stack those children, but yet when my daughter was on her 13th case plan and 13th caseworker, which is another problem, she had to have a bedroom for each child plus herself. Now, what this foster care provider did is she wound up adopting my three grandchildren. And not only did she adopt my three grandchildren, but she continued to have foster care kids. I ran a background on her. And, Jim, she put as her income is $100,000 a year. Now, this is a woman that doesn't work. She took and they built a brand-new two-story home in a neighboring county, over 2,000 square feet, out for the backs of these children. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is ASFA, this is what Jim and I are talking about. Foster care providers, and not all of them are bad, ladies and gentlemen, so don't start sending me hate mail, but 99% of them will tell you they're in it for the money. It's extra income. It's tax-free. They don't have to claim it on their taxes. Even after they adopt the child, they do not have to claim it on the taxes. Plus, they get up to a $40,000 adoption credit on their taxes. They don't have to pay any medical bills. They don't have to pay anything on these children that they have stolen. So, yes, and that takes us back to the caseworker going into the doctor's office and soliciting business because, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the month, these caseworkers get a bonus for every child they have removed and placed and adopted out. No. So continue with your story, Jim. I'm sorry, I got off on a rant. But
it's easy to do. Anytime you talk CPS, you start out with certain things on your mind. But then the slightest little thing will change the whole perspective of what you're dealing with.
And when you said she was in the doctor's office, I'm going, yes, she's looking for a paycheck.
Right. And I don't know how many times. And another thing is, once you're in the system, the slightest little thing, you've got somebody knocking at your door.
Absolutely.
The kids came home, March will be 3 years, and during that time we have had 8 cases that we have had to deal with.
Oh, my word.
Now, they do tend to back off whenever I give them my business card, but that in itself tells you that something's not right, because they shouldn't treat me any differently than anybody else.
Well, because they operate on intimidation.
Right.
And they cannot intimidate you. They're going to go find somebody else that can intimidate. And ladies and gentlemen, they operate on intimidation and threat.
And the, now, I haven't mentioned it on the air. We had a caseworker leave 30 minutes before we came on the air tonight because of my 5-year-old and 8-year-old got into a fight a couple of days ago, and the 5-year-old gave the 8-year-old a black eye. He went to school yesterday, and they filed a report.
For the love of Pete.
So the kids are scared to death. They're coming back tomorrow and doing a full. One of the things that I had the lady read was the immunity statute. And she says, so what does this mean to me? And I said, excuse me? I said, are you not a DSPS employee? And she said, yes. I said, well, this is Chapter 40 that gives y'all the authority to operate. If you don't recognize that a law from the very chapter that gives you the authority to operate, how can you conduct proper investigations? Now, this particular one is a rarity for us. We actually got one that is a licensed social worker. Texas does not use social workers. We use caseworkers, and they don't have to necessarily be licensed.
Oh, my word.
So, you can have an art degree and be a caseworker in Texas.
That's scary.
Or have an art or you can have an associate's degree in art and work 2 years at a hospital facility or work as a support staff at CPS. If you have 2 or more years experience, they will hire you with an associate's degree. Now, that's how desperate they are for workers in Texas. They're not even going as far as having full 4-year degrees. But like I said, to me, the 4-year degree doesn't matter if you don't have it in criminology or social work or something that relates to the work.
A 4-year degree doesn't mean a hill of beans if you've never been a parent either, because you got some 20-year-old wet behind the ear, I know more than you do, knocks on your door and says, well, you're not treating your child right. How the hell do they know? Are they a parent?
Yeah, that's true. You get them fresh out of college. Okay, even with the vetting process, you're looking, say, a 4-year degree, you're looking at maybe age 23. They've been in school all their lives. They have very little real-life experience. So, but they're trying to tell you how to run your household. So it's a very big problem.
And because, number one, they don't have any life experience. And number two, they've never had children. Number three, they've forgotten how they behaved as a child. And number four, they don't have any business telling someone how to parent their child, because children, like adults, are unique. No two children are the same. So what they learn in the books is certainly not real life.
Oh, yeah. I can verify in this group we got all three of these boys are totally opposite one another. I mean, what works with one will not work with another. I mean, one, you can talk to him and stick him in a corner and you're totally heartbroken him. Another one, you can pop him on the butt with your hand over something. He'll whimper and cry, but by the time he gets to the end of the hallway, he's looking at you like, oh, why'd you do that?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so, and then we have the one that was gone for so long. He was raised with a whole different set of rules. And so we're, even after almost 3 years, we're still trying to adjust with how to handle him, because like we said earlier, to us, we're the strangers.
And he was 5 years old when you got him back, and the Catholic Church has always said, give me a child until they're 7 years old, and I will, their personality will be formed for life. And that is true, because those people had that child during his informative years.
Yes, he was 9 months old when they took him. Now, we were lucky that they were placed with with fictive kin. It's my granddaughter's ex-step-grandmother that took them. They had already divorced from her grandfather, but her and her significant other took them in, and so it was kind of like family, but they weren't. They were considered fictive kin.
Right.
And because we did have a decent relationship with them, D'Angelo still gets to go back and visit them from time to time. So it's not quite like he just came home and he doesn't have that relationship. We were very lucky that we maintained that, simply because it was so hard on him coming home. But and the main reason they came home was in long-term foster care, Texas has a review every 6 months. And at one of the reviews, the caseworker had quit. And her supervisor showed up. Well, she had only quit a week before, so the judge let it ride for another 6 months. We got to the next hearing, and this time the supervisor's supervisor showed up instead. And the judge started asking questions, and that's when he found out that they had not reassigned a caseworker to our case for 6 months. So that's when he realized that after so many years, they weren't actually working our case. They were just prolonging it. And he ordered a homesteading, and the children were home 6 weeks later.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to real quickly let our listening audience know, especially people that are fighting the corruption that is CPS. Number one, ladies and gentlemen, you do have the right to, A, to not open the door and let those people in. The only way that they can come in your house is with a warrant. And you have a right to refuse to allow anyone in your home without a warrant. Number two, you have a right to all of the records in your file. They will try to tell you it's confidential. That is bullshit. You have a right, and you will have to beat them about the head and shoulders, but you have a right to everything in your file. Number three, You have a right to have witnesses on your behalf at every hearing. They will try to tell you that you don't, that the courtroom is too small, that you cannot cross-examine the caseworkers or their supervisors or anybody else. That is bullshit. You have a right to cross-examine the witnesses and to have witnesses on your behalf. You have a right to call them to the stand. And number four, you have a right to the best, damn, meanest attorney you can find, and do not get one that is in the county you are in because they're all in bed with the judge. You have a right to fight for your children. You have a right to visit your children if they are removed, and if the foster care provider refuses to allow you to visit with those children, you have a right to fight that. What else have I left out real quickly, Jim?
You pretty much covered it. You do need to, if you become involved, you need to set up what I call a casebook. I have people get a 4 or 5 subject spiral binder. You want a section in there for your contact list. Anytime you try and call them, make contact with them, you want to write it down. If it's a failed contact, you want to make a note of that it was an attempted. Same thing when they call you, you want to keep a running log of all contact with them.
And you also, in states where you can record, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't mean to jump in, but I don't want to forget this. You have a right to two things. You have a right to video them. You have a right to record them. And if they tell you you don't have that right, especially in the state of Georgia, you only have to have the permission of one person to consent who is in the conversation. You were one of the two people who are in the conversation. You have given yourself permission to record and to video it. So you have a right to do it, and don't let them tell you any different. Right, Jim?
That's correct. What you'll want to do, generally I find that information under report on reporters' websites. You can look up and find out whether you are a single or dual party state. Most states are single party, which means you, as long as you know that it's been recorded, it's legal.
Now,
if you've got an older child that is old enough to understand that they're being recorded, they can record their interview because
Absolutely. They
are party at that interview. And as long as they understand that, you can record what went on in that interview.
Real quickly, because we're going to run out of time, give everybody the websites where they can go and get information, both websites, the Angel Eyes Over Texas and the buying and selling of our.
Okay. We have the buying and selling website is a blog post. So we give information about, I forget the full name because we have a fairly long one. Yvonne, do you have that?
Just look under my name under CPS.
Okay. And then under Angel Eyes, remember the acronym AEOV, as in Victor, RT. If you Google that, you will find all of our, or put in the name Angel Eyes Over Texas, you will find all of our web presence. We have Facebook groups for all 11 regions in Texas. We have our general site. I track the changes to the handbook because, as I said earlier,
Jim, I'm sorry. They're going to cut us off real quick. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to bring him back. Join us tomorrow night when we interview Teresa Hisong, and I will be bringing Jim back so we can continue this. Until then, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Boy, that hour went by fast. We're in archives now, so anybody that... that listens to the archives will hear us. That hour flew by.
Yeah, it did.
I want to bring you back after the first of the year.
Okay.
So we can keep this in the forefront.
And hopefully by then we're getting our early bill filing right now in Texas. And January 10th session starts. And hopefully after the first of the year we'll know better what kind of legislation that we've got pending. We have one of my favorite representatives popped up with an idea here a month or so ago of using Miranda-like warnings to the parents when they come out and talk to you. Now, this one today is the first time they have actually handed out a parent's guide when she approached, which that tells me that this one knows her job a little better than most.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a 6-page guide that it's a parent's guide to the Child and Protective Services investigation, which, you know, that has been a rule for years, but this is the first time they actually gave us a guide in all of my dealings with them. So,
well, the interesting thing will be is if they live by the guide.
Right. And I don't know if you knew, our new commissioner is a former Texas Ranger. They went with a law enforcement person to run Texas CPS. So and I started mentioning earlier about his dual approach. It appears that he's using kind of what I call good cop, bad cop situation. You've got the forensic bureau that can tell whether or not it's a criminal action, but then you have the social worker that can come in and offer actual services and go that route. And I'm expecting big things out of this commissioner. He and I, when we talked in July, we only had about 10 minutes, so we didn't get into a lot of stuff, but he came to me. I didn't approach him. So that again tells me a little bit of something. We were at the Capitol, and I had just got through testifying, and he come up and introduced himself to me, and that told me a lot. He's wanting to hear what, when he stuck out his hand, he says, "I understand you're a person in Texas that I need to know."
Wow.
I think we are going to make progress this next year. I'm writing up a new business model that I call the Department of Family Preservation Services. And remove the protection part of it, because a working family is going to protect their children.
Exactly.
And follow it out to where investigations and substitute care is separate from the actual services. Also, instead of investigating CPS, APS, and licensing as separate entities, we believe that they should be combined together, because there's services that is offered through APS that can help families across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should be treated as a family situation and not a strictly child protection or adult protection situation. So that is some of the things that I'm trying to work on for this coming legislature.
So if I bring you back in April, there, some of those things should either be in the works or beginning to get in the works.
By April, we should have a good solid list of family-related statutes that are, or bills that are pending. We just had to do what I call, one thing I like about this commissioner, he'll admit is this is a huge ship and it's going to take something to turn it.
Uh-huh.
And they allotted him $150 million last week to as an emergency patch to hire more workers. But as far as I see, that's just a tugboat pushing it back on course until it can wander off course again.
Exactly.
It's not solving the problem. All it is getting you back on course long enough for you to figure out the problem. And I think that there's been enough negativity this year over this, even with the federal masters from the federal court issuing their requirements. I don't see where they address the constitutional violations, and that's one reason Texas Attorney General filed his motion against it. But they define the systematic problems that exist in the system. And that's what I think Texas needs to do is sit back and come up with a solution to present to the federal court and say, okay, we recognize we've got a problem. Here's how we plan to deal with it and see if the court will take our proposal over what their special masters came up with.
That would be excellent
because,
if they will do that.
Well, they're fighting because they feel like the feds are stepping on their toes, but they sure don't fight when that federal check comes in each month.
No, they don't. They stand there with their hand out.
And you're talking about the federal money for Texas is over $800 million a year. And, and our budget, our CPS budget is now over $2 billion per year to operate our, we've got more than almost 15,000 employees involved, and we're still shorthanded. So we have to redefine how we go about doing things, and that's part of what I'm working with on developing a dispatch system opposed to just assigning cases. I've been working on a dispatch system that uses GPS location so that whenever a new case opens up for that first round assessment, they can look on their phone and say, oh, wow, there's an investigation that needs to be taken care of a mile away. They can go in and take care of that and move on. And then the same thing on the backside, I'm looking at case pooling to where you don't have a caseworker actually assigned to your case. They do their reports, and you may have four or five different caseworkers that you deal with, and then your case is summarized from their reports. And that way you don't have a caseworker that absolutely don't like you filing a report, and then you also got those that would let you slide. So it's a whole different way of looking at things. All reports would use redaction on the fly so that any discovery or report that you get is simply a print command away. You shouldn't have to wait 6-7 months to get a copy of records because they have to be redacted. And
well, let's let's continue this conversation in April.
Okay.
And anybody that listens to the archives is going to hear everything that we've been talking about even after the show is over, so that'll give them a little added information. And then when I bring you back in April, hopefully some of these things will either be on the table or up in front of your legislature or maybe even passed.
Yes.
All right, my dear.
Well, let's probably... Okay. It went good. Like you said, time flew by. So,
It did.
It's talking with you and look forward to talking again in April. Have a good
night. Thank you. You too. Thank you so much, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.